was actually a session that I was asked to give just a few hours ago. What happened was, I don't know if any of you knew Dr. Edmund Lipsitz, who worked for the UJA.
Lipsitz,
right. Oh, I know his son Jeffrey. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah. So Jeffrey goes by Lipsitz.
Yeah, when
instead
I
of Lipsitz.
My husband was the Board of Education chair.
Yeah, no.
Rabbi Lipsitz used to come all the time.
So that's him. So his son Jeffrey, helps me out when I do classes for doctors. He always helps arrange things. And he asked me if I would do a session for the 10th yard site of his father on remembering the victims and survivors of the Holocaust. And I was surprised when he asked me to do it to realize that I've never actually taught something like that. It comes up in the context of other things. It comes up in classes about memory and that sort of thing, but I've never actually done something about remembering that generation. And so it actually was just a few hours ago, Shari Shemayim, and knowing that I was putting this together for that, I said, you know what, let me also discuss it here, because Jewish identity very much ties into this issue of how we look at the generation of the Holocaust and commemorate both the victims and both the victims who lost their lives and the victims who survived, in our own day. I also felt like it was a little bit of an atonement for me to do this, because I felt bad for years about the fact that, you know, when we were having our kids. So we named for certain relatives, but we basically exhausted the pool of immediate family and didn't go further afield, like the great aunt or the great uncle, who, you know, didn't have anybody named for them because they didn't have descendants. And I always felt like that. Yeah, that's the problem. When you're naming your kids, you're too young to really do it properly. So they have great names, and the names fit them, and everything
the
should be good.
Guilt.
But okay, well, I'm glad to hear it's a common guilt. It's not just just me. But I felt like, okay, so this is an opportunity to atone somewhat. And what I called the session, as you see at the top of the page, is remembering a holy generation. And so what I want to do is take this in three parts. First, this term, a holy generation, because the term in Hebrew is a kadosh. And that's a very loaded term in Hebrew. And I want to talk about how we apply that term a little bit. Then talk about why we memorialize this generation. What are we trying to accomplish when we remember them? Is it just, well, they were our family, they're our blood, therefore we remember, or is there something more going on? And then finally, after that, to talk about the models of memory and what we do in order to remember, because what I see in terms of the way we remember that generation, I feel like we're doing one thing, but we're skipping another, and you'll see what I mean when we get there. I feel like there are two parts to the way we remember, and we excel at one, and we don't really do the other. So that's what I want to discuss. But first, this term, a holy generation. You know, what is the term kadosh refer to when we talk about people like the victims of the Holocaust? What does the term kadosh mean, besides saying, well, it means holy?
The idea of kadosh means set aside, or something out of the, or regular. And I think that the victims of the Shoah are kind of a different category of victim, but it's something that doesn't fit into any category. So they're separate.
Good. So kadosh certainly is. It means separate, designated for a particular role, a particular purpose. Very true. But I'm getting at something else with the way we use the word kadosh.
Well, I just want to disagree with you, because I don't feel they're separate. I feel they're us. We just didn't live there. It could have been us.
No.
I think that was really
she wasn't being separate.
That's not what I meant,
right.
But you're right, of course. Yeah.
That it's an incident that is apart from everything else that's happened to our people.
The term kadoshim is a term that we have used historically for people who died al kiddush Hashem, to sanctify God's name. That was always the way the term was used. A kadosh meant a martyr, effectively. But when you use that term for this generation, you have to be a little bit more careful. When we talk about who is Kadosh, the term doesn't quite fit the generation of the Holocaust in the neat way that it did, let's say, for victims of the Crusades, victims of the expulsions. It's not quite the same for reasons that I'm going to explain. First, I wanted to show you a beautiful quote from Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. Soloveitchik, the Rosh Yeshiva, the head of Yeshiva University, was also the rabbi of a community in Onset, in Massachusetts. And he, on Tisha B'Av, the day that's designated for mourning for the Beis HaMikdash, for the temple, he used to lead the kinos, the prayers, the not really prayers, the eulogies of grief and mourning that are recited all day on Tisha B'Av. And while everybody was fasting, he would...
Rabbi Soloveitchik used to lead a session all day long in which he would introduce a paragraph and then they would say it. And then he would introduce the next paragraph and then they would recite the paragraph. And these keynotes, I only have one, so that's it, the one that I need. These keynotes, these elegies, were for the destruction of the temple. They were for, as well, the destruction of various communities in the time of the Crusades, and different catastrophes that have befallen us over the generations. So I had the opportunity to transcribe the lectures of Rabbi Soloveitchik many years ago, and I kept the transcripts. And this is from one of them from the year 1980, because he did this year after year. So this is from the 1980 transcript, from introducing a keynote called, a eulogy call, or an elegy called Mi Yitain Roshi, which is an elegy for communities in Europe that were destroyed during the Crusades. This particular one, well, you'll see his introduction. He says, "We mourn not only the Gedolei Yisrael, the leaders of Israel, but plain people, plain Yisraelim, plain Jews. For instance," he says, "I remember myself," and he talks about his cheder, his school, back in Chaslavich, the town in Europe where he grew up. He says, "My cheder where I was, which I abandoned as a very young boy, my cheder was a large room rented from a carpenter. He was called Reb Eli the Stoler. We used to come to shul, to the cheder, to go through the workshop. He used to stand the whole day working as a carpenter, working and saying Tehillim. He would say Psalms. He knew Tehillim by heart. Boys, I mean young boys, we didn't pay too much attention. He hardly knew how to translate a Mishnah, to understand the Mishnah well. But I am convinced, and I heard it from my father, if there was ever a Jew which was counted among the Lamed Vav Nistarim," the idea of Lamed Vav Nis, the 36 righteous people who are hidden and nobody realizes how pious they are, but they're the ones who maintain the world. If there was one of them, it was Reb Eli the Stoler, this plain carpenter. So his point here, the point that he's trying to make, is that when we speak of the holy ones of that time, it doesn't mean the people of superlative righteousness. It means the random Jew also. However, there's more here, and this takes me to the question of who qualifies as holy. You see, classically, what it meant to be a martyr was some enemy, Romans, Greeks, Babylonians, or further along in history, Spanish, British, Catholics, whoever it was, would put you up to a challenge. They would say to you, "We don't like the fact that you are Jewish." They couched it in whatever terminology was relevant for the empire of the time. And you have a choice. You can convert, abandon your Judaism, or we lash you, take away your property, expel you, burn you at the stake, whatever was the punishment du jour. Right? That's what we're familiar with as martyrdom. But that's not what happened in the Holocaust. Right? If somebody was being led to the gas chambers in a camp, and they said, "Well, I want to renounce my Judaism," what would the Germans have said?
"Too bad.
Too bad. We don't care."
Yeah.
It was ethnic. It wasn't about religion. For them, it wasn't a matter of Judaism. It was a matter of wiping out the race. Whether it originated with Judaism, Nietzsche, and whatever else, isn't the point. The point is that, in that sense, it's not martyrdom. Because you had many of them for whom, had they been given the option, had they been told, "Renounce your Judaism and you'll survive," they would have said, "Okay, we'll renounce it and we'll survive." So the question is, does that qualify as a martyr? So here I refer you to an article by Rabbi Dr. Yechezkel Lichtenstein of Bar Ilan University on defining Kiddush Hashem, defining sanctification of God's name and martyrdom in the period of the Shoah, the period of the Holocaust. And he says, number two, this is my translation, the original's in the Hebrew. He says, in the period of the Shoah, there was no Kiddush Hashem in the traditional sense. Kiddush Hashem, sanctification of God's name, in which Jews are killed or take their own lives for their faith. In that terrible period, Jews were not put to the test of saving their lives by converting. They could not choose between life and death, for the essential factor in the eyes of the murderers was not religion, but race. But it is clear that Kiddush Hashem also has two aspects, visible and hidden. There is Kiddush Hashem of openly sacrificing one's life for fulfillment of Torah and its laws. There's the traditional form of sanctifying God's name, where a person says, I insist on standing as a Jew no matter what you do to me. That's the visible and traditional form. But there is also Kiddush Hashem via the existence of a Jew as a Jew, just surviving, just existing. That in and of itself is an act of sanctifying God's name. When the Nazis wished to eliminate Israel from the world, even fighting to live was an act of Kiddush Hashem. One should include among the holy ones not only those who were murdered, but also those who were rescued, who succeeded in living in all conditions. They too count as holy ones, as Kedoshim. And he brings sources to support it from the liturgy and the way we don't differentiate in the liturgy between those who died for one reason or those who died for another reason. And he quotes Kat Setnik, if you're not familiar, Yechiel Dinur, right. Well, that was his name when he came to Israel. He was Yechiel Feiner, and then he became Yechiel Dinur.
Ben-Zion Dinur,
I think it's Yechiel, but I could
Dinur
be wrong.
Dinur, anyway.
But yes, but he wrote under a pen name when he wrote about the Holocaust. He felt this was who he was, and he was representing the victims of the Holocaust, and he called himself Kat Setnik, which I'm told means somebody who was in the camps. That's the term. So Kasetnik also wrote, now, dying is not heroic. The most heroic act is now to live. So all of them count as heroes, and all of them count on one level or another as Kedoshim, as holy ones. And those are the people we want to remember. But that brings me to the second part, which is, why do we remember? Beyond saying, well, of course, they're our family, we have to remember, what does it do for us? What are we accomplishing when we remember them? What's the goal?
We're keeping a bond. We're part, they're still, we feel that they were part of us, and their remembrance keeps them part of us.
So we're keeping them alive, is what we're keeping them a part of the nation.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's also the same way that you say to remember the Exodus. In other words, not to repeat it, not to let it happen again. And that's not the only reason for remembering the Exodus. It's also how you treat the stranger.
Right, you're talking about remembering being a slave.
Yes.
Not remembering the Exodus was fine.
Remember being a stranger in a foreign land.
Right.
And how you treat.
Right.
Another person.
Right.
If this happened then, it could happen again.
That's another
but
one.
That's the point. Yes. Yeah, go ahead.
Does it also mean keeping the memory alive? Because if we carry on the tradition, we constantly remember. We continue to remember over the generations.
Right. But what's the value of that remembering? Is it just remembering for the sake of remembering, or is there some and
probably something deeper than that, but that sets it going.
Right.
True.
That's the model.
It's continuity to reinforce your belief.
It's continuity to reinforce your belief. It's that there wasn't, they didn't live in, and ultimately die in vain. Right? There's the sense of, when I did this program earlier this afternoon, someone had said, you don't want to give the Nazis a victory.
Yeah.
They didn't succeed in wiping these people out. Their people, their memory still is still here, and lives on as an inspiration for people. There are, what I would say is that although what you're saying is all true and goes beyond what I'm saying, but I would like to identify three particular imperatives for remembering. The first encompasses the never again point, but broader than that, the practical lessons of their experience. The idea that the whether it's learning how to see the warning signs and act when you see warning signs, or whether it's how to deal with these things when they come about, learning from them how they coped and how they dealt with it, there are practical lessons to be learned. I brought you a verse which is a classic for it, source number 3, from towards the end of the book of Deuteronomy, in which we are told, Zechor Yemot Olam, remember the days of eternity. Understand the years of each generation. Ask your father, he'll tell you. Ask your elders, they will tell you. There's an imperative of memory. Professor Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi, a professor at Columbia University, wrote that for Jews, it's not really about history, it's about memory. The difference between history and memory is not semantic. History can be in a book somewhere. It's the record of what happened. Memory is what I remember. It's part of me. It's not just something that was where I can have a reference book somewhere. It's with me. And that's what we're talking about. Remembering those days is meant to influence us and to teach us lessons. And here I brought the classic Santayana quote, because you can't discuss the importance of remembering these things if you don't bring this quote. Source number 4. There are others like this among the Romans and so on, but you can't do it without Santayana. Number 4, he says, progress, far from consisting in change, depends on retentiveness. It's a brilliant point. Before you get to his famous words, which are coming at the end. If progress to you only means change, then you'll never learn anything from that change. You never learn anything from the past. You need to know the difference between what was and what is. That's what progress is. When change is absolute, if you just throw everything old out and you create something new, there remains no being to improve. No direction is set for possible improvement. And when experience is not retained, as among savages, infancy is perpetual. Right? You're just like a baby every day. If you don't remember what was, then it's just like I opened my eyes this morning and the world is brand new. And I never knew what it had been before and I didn't learn anything from what happened. And so he says, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Because if you don't know what happened, that's exactly where you're going to go again. Now, it's very important to note that when we talk about what it means to remember this and to learn lessons from it, we don't necessarily refer to learning the data. The data matters. What year this happened, the name of the town, how many people, those matter. But they're not the end of this. And here I bring you a quote from Rabbi Chaim Berlin. Rabbi Chaim Berlin was the son, one of the sons, of Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, I've quoted him on other occasions in our group, was the head of the last great Eastern European yeshiva. It's considered generally the greatest of the last several centuries, called Voloshin. He was the last head of the yeshiva. And he greatly admired another rabbi who was from before his time, the Rabbi Akiva Eger. Rabbi Akiva Eger was from Posen in the 18th century. Rabbi Berlin was from late 19th century into the beginning of the 20th, so they never saw each other. But he was an admirer of the work of Rabbi Akiva Eger. So his son, Rabbi Chaim Berlin, let's see if we keep all the names straight, Rabbi Chaim Berlin reports what happened, what his father's reaction was when they brought out a biography of his great idol, Rabbi Akiva Eger. Mm-hmm. Take a look at number 5. Rabbi Chaim Berlin writes, with my own ears, I heard from his father's, Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin's holy mouth, when the biography of Rabbi Akiva Eger was brought before his eyes, published for the first time in Berlin in 1862. He did not want to look at it for so much as an instant, saying, all of this is within the Jerusalem Talmud statement, we do not construct monuments for the righteous, their words are their memorial. We don't need to build monuments, and I'm not saying now, I'm not against Holocaust memorials, that's not the point. But he says, the way you remember somebody is through their ideas, through what they represented. He says, what will come of my knowing the day of his birth or death, whether his face looked thus or thus? the essence is to put our eye and heart to the words of his teachings. He said, I know him better now than I will from some biography with the details of when he was born and when he died. And I think there's it is important to know dates, and it is important to know places. I think fundamentally we need to know more, not to substitute data for meaning. Right? That's one of the big sins of my generation with the internet, is a substitution of data for meaning. We think that because we have large amounts of information, we don't need to analyze it and figure out what it all means, because we can just quote statistics. This is not a good thing. So that the first element here is to learn the practical lessons of their experience, understanding who they were, what they represented, and what they did. Second level, more abstract. To shape our identity and vision by connecting with the lives they led. Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, in source number 6, speaks about this in a different context. He's talking about why it's important for a Jewish curriculum and a Jewish school to include history. And forget the history and memory split, we'll go with the word history because that's what he's talking about. He says it's really important that we learn history because it defines who we are. It defines our identity. And he writes, take a look at 6, he says, here then, we have a people that emerged from the course of world history, that's us, the Jews, that was placed into the midst of the nations to advance the goals of world history. We're supposed to move events forward, create progress. And that was endowed with historical vision. Should not the sons of such a people understand that historical studies of the development of nations are truly not superfluous? It's not just the sons, it's the daughters too. Shouldn't they understand that history is necessary? They are, in fact, virtually indispensable. And what he's getting at is, our identity is shaped by who we have been. And not me in my lifetime, but who our nation has been. And that's something that you see throughout the Torah. Pearlie mentioned before, repeatedly the Torah says, you shall remember that you were slaves in Egypt. You know, why does the Torah do that? Every time it does it, the context, or pretty much every time it does that, the context for the statement, remember that you were slaves in Egypt, is, therefore be kind to the stranger. Therefore take care of the vulnerable. Be shaped in the way you look at yourself by the experience of your nation. I was never a slave. Yeah, but you were. Because our nation was, and therefore you were too. It's about shaping our identity based on what came before us. That's the idea. There's a mitzvah called Bikurim. The Bikurim are the first fruits. The farmer every year brings the first fruits to the temple, and he has a little speech that he has to say. It may be familiar because it's part of the classic Haggadah. In the Hebrew, it goes Arami Oved Avi Vayered Mitzrayma Vayagar Sham Bimseimaat. In the English, an Aramean tried to destroy my father, or some editions may have a wandering Aramean was my father. There are two different versions. But an Aramean tried to destroy my father. He descended to Egypt. He dwelled there in small numbers, and so on. He became a great nation. Why do we do this to the farmer? The poor guy, you know, he's a good man, or a good woman, for that matter. They went to the field, took the first produce, said, I'm going to bring it to the temple as a gift, and now you make him recite his bar mitzvah parsha. He has to now give a speech. What are we doing there with that? And the answer is that the farmer has to remember our history. The history is what defines who we are. You're not just a farmer who has olives and grapes and figs to bring, right? It's not who you are. You are the representative of a nation which was given this land for a purpose. That shapes who you are too, farmer. Yeah.
Is it going too far to say what happened is part of our DNA?
Yeah, I think it is.
Some people
That's exactly
say,
correct.
Yeah, that our age group, it's part of our DNA. And part, some of the problem with some of the younger people who are very critical of tradition, that they don't realize that it's part of their DNA.
Right, absolutely. It is. And especially when we act it out. Professor Yerushalmi, who I quoted before, about history and memory, talks about this as reactualization. We're not recollecting something, we're actually reactualizing it every time we have a Seder, every time we do these things. we're reliving it, and it becomes part of our DNA anew, so to speak, embedded in a still stronger way. You ever hear of Oliver Sacks, Dr. Oliver Sacks?
Of course.
Okay.
Dialogue.
That's right. It was last year, 2 years ago. So from his classic, right, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, take a look at source number 7. When he talks about the importance of memory for a person's identity and what happens when somebody can't remember, he says, if we wish to know about a man, we ask, what is his story, his real inmost story? For each of us is a biography, a story. To be ourselves, we must have ourselves, possess, if need be, repossess our life stories. We must recollect ourselves, recollect the inner drama, the narrative of ourselves. A man needs such a narrative, a continuous inner narrative to maintain his identity, his self. That's what gives us a sense of who we are. So as a nation, when we remember these people, and not just the facts, but when we remember how they lived, what they valued, how they looked at the world, that shapes our identity, how we see ourselves, because we are part of that nation. And then a third level, right? First is the practical benefits, the practical lessons. Second is the shaping of identity. And then third is the element of honoring them. You know, there's a mitzvah in the Torah of kibud avaim, right? Honoring your parents. So the Talmud asks, how do you honor your parents when they're alive? And it says, so you help them by escorting them different places. You give them food if they need food. You don't sit in their spot. There are mitzvahs. There are two different mitzvahs, two different commandments. One of honoring and the other of revering. And those actually are different. Honoring is the positive things that you do to provide honor. And revering is refraining from doing things that would dishonor them. Sorry? Yeah, we have both. So the question, though, is, so what happens when they pass away? Does that end the mitzvah? And the Talmud says, no, it doesn't end the mitzvah. The mitzvah continues even after they pass on. So the Talmud asks, but how? I can't give them food to eat. I can't escort them anywhere. So what am I supposed to do? So take a look at source number 8. How does one honor a parent after their passing? When quoting him, and it's not just him, it's also her, one should not say, so said my father, my father said X, but so said my father and teacher, may I be the atonement for his passing. In the Hebrew, Hareini Kaparas Mishkavo. But, lest you say, well, I never heard anybody say that, keep on reading. This is within 12 months. That's the practice for the first year. After that, one says something that will be more familiar. May his memory be a blessing for life in the next world. Zichrono livracha, l'chaye olam haba. So zichrono livracha, when a person says zal, right, the z lamed as people write it in English, but zichrono livracha, his memory should be a blessing, you're actually fulfilling a biblical mitzvah of honoring your parents. Now, the question, of course, is, why is that an act of honoring them? In order to know that, you need to know where that phrase comes from. The Talmud didn't make it up. It's a verse in Mishlei, in Proverbs. The verse goes, Zecher tzadik livracha, v'shem rishaim yirkav. Which means, the second half of it is the negative half. I'm going to start with that one. That the name of the wicked should rot. That's the second half. The first half, though, is, the memory of the righteous is a blessing. And so what you're doing every time you say, this is what my mother said, her memory should be a blessing, is you're calling her tzadik. You're calling her righteous. And that's a way to honor them. That's the mitzvah of honoring.
Easter service too. Just
absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
What's the word we say in kavod, kaved et avicha? What's the word for revere? You use two English.
Mora. The verse is ish imo ve'aviv tira'u, that one should have awe or reverence for father and mother. The same word.
So it's the same
word as for fear.
As your, well, awe. Let's
yes.
Use
well, that's
awe,
the thing.
So
it's because it's a spectrum. Right.
Okay.
Yes,
okay.
That's the term. Okay. So we have a mitzvah of honoring them even after their death, and it's not just this line out of the Talmud. That's actually recorded in Maimonides, the Code of Jewish Law, that this is a particular mitzvah. So when we actively remember them, when we take steps to remember them, that shows we value them, that we consider them part of our present and not just our past. It shows that this zichrono livracha is not just lip service, but it actually has meaning.
It isn't, yeah. Doesn't it mean, of course, there are deeds involved with that? It's not just enough to say that bracha and go and shoot somebody.
Definitely true. I'm coming to that, although I didn't think of the example of not shooting people. That didn't cross my mind. What we've seen then is the concept of a holy generation. And what we've seen is that there are three reasons to commemorate them. There may be more, as some people said, things that don't quite fit neatly into these three categories. But we have the element of practical lessons. We have the element of bringing their identity into ours, shaping who we are. And we have the element of showing them honor. So what I want to talk about now is how we do that. Because I said in the beginning, there are two ways to do this. And I feel like we do one really well, and the other one is rarely done. And here I want to draw on a model from Jewish law involving two Hebrew terms. One term is Zecher leChurban, and the other term is Zecher leMikdash. Zecher means
in memory of
a memorial. What is Churban?
Destruction.
Sorry?
I'm sorry.
Destruction. And Mikdash, right, the temple, the sanctuary, correct. Both of these can be brought to bear. Both these are separate concepts in Jewish law, and both of them are relevant here. And when I started thinking this through, I went looking around online, and lo and behold, I found an article, which I actually saw many years ago, and I completely forgotten about. So it could be that when I came up with this idea, I was just channeling what I had seen years before. It could be it's not my own. But it's an article by the Bostoner Rebbe, Reb Levi Yitzchak Horowitz, which I'm going to quote a couple of times in the course of the next few minutes. But two fundamental issues, remembering Churban, destruction, and remembering Mikdash, the sanctuary. These are two very different things. First of all, Zechel Churban, remembering the destruction. When someone says remembering the destruction, what does that mean to you?
So it's a destruction of the Beit Mikdash, isn't it? And the destruction of our independence, really.
True. But what are you remembering when it says, remember the destruction? It means you're remembering...
The temple?
Not the temple, sorry.
What happened before it was destroyed.
Nope. We'll get to that. Remembering the pain. Remembering the destruction means remembering the pain, remembering the grief. Which is very hard to do when you're dealing with the temple, which, you know, to quote the halachic term, is avelut yeshana. It's an old type of grief and mourning, and therefore it's very hard for people to feel what that is. It's easier to feel it with the Holocaust than it is to feel it about something that was 2,000 years ago. But the idea is to express a sense of pain over what happened. And there are all sorts of examples for how we do that. Take a look at your sheet at number 9, please. This is from the Mishnah, so we're going back now to the period when the temple was actually destroyed. Those, you know, to them, the destruction of the temple was like what the Holocaust is to us. It's that same type of a time offset. So they said in Vespasian's invasion was an earlier Roman invasion, not the one that resulted in the ultimate destruction of the temple, but just before that. So when he invaded, they made a decree. They said grooms could no longer wear crowns. The practice going back historically was that a bride and groom at a wedding came out with crowns. They said no more crowns for the groom. As a matter of fact, if you go to a Jewish wedding, you know how when first the groom comes down and then when the bride comes down, everybody stands up? So it's not because they all want to see better and they want to admire her gown. It's because the bride and the groom on the day of their wedding have the status of king and queen. And the law is, you stand for the king, you stand for the queen, and therefore you are demonstrating respect. There's a whole lot of discussion about this within Jewish law. So they used to wear crowns, but they said, no more crowns for the groom. We're grieving. And they also said, we're not going to use the drums anymore as part of the instruments that they would play. They felt reducing their music was appropriate. And then in the invasion of Titus, which was the one that actually destroyed the Second Temple, the year 68 or 70 of the Common Era, they said also the brides, they're not going to have crowns anymore. They held on to that longer, but ultimately dropped that as well. Another example, the month of Av. The month of Av, which occurs during the summer, is the month of Tisha B'Av, when we commemorate the destruction of the temple. Take a look at number 10. When the month of Av enters, we reduce our joy. In the week of Tisha B'Av, we may neither cut hair nor do laundry. The idea is to demonstrate grief, to experience what that pain was like. Another example from number 11, a traditional Jewish practice. One may line his home with lime. Lining with lime was like a whitewashing. It was a way to paint the home white, and it would be sparkling and clean. It would look nice. You're allowed to do that, omitting a bit, but you have to leave something out. It should be incomplete. How much? Rav Yosef said, 1 square cubit. A cubit is, according to one measure, 21.6 inches. It's between 1.5 and 2 feet, different number in the metric system. I didn't grow up here. But it's basically from here to here or so. Yeah. So so Rav Yosef says 1 square cubit. Rav Chista said it should be opposite the entrance of the home. In other words, not just the month of Av and not just at the wedding, but every day when I go into my house, when I come out of my house, I am going to be reminded of the destruction of the temple. And this is about feeling pain. So I leave it incomplete. And there's more. I didn't bring everything there. There was a practice of setting up the meal at home and leaving something out of the meal. And this isn't just like an ancient practice like done 2,000 years ago. This is something, the idea of leaving something unfinished in the home is actually practiced till today. That's a contemporary practice. Not everybody, but so what else is new? But the point is to reenact the loss, to make the pain part of our experience on some level. However, there's a big however. The however is we have to be careful not to go too far, not to sink so far into this pain and grief that we can never progress. So if you take a look at source number 12, you get a fascinating discussion. From that same passage that talks about the home and leaving a part of the home unfinished. When the Second Temple was destroyed, there were many Jews who separated, not wishing to eat meat or drink wine. They said, you know what? We're not going to have meat or wine anymore. So at first blush, you look at that and say, yeah, they didn't want to have meat and wine because those are celebratory. You don't want to have something that's that enjoyable. That wasn't it. Rabbi Yehoshua dealt with them. Rabbi Yehoshua, sage of the time, said, I'm going to put a stop to this. He said to them, my children, why do you neither eat meat nor drink wine? And they replied, should we eat meat? That's what you bring on the altar, and it's now halted. Meaning, that used to be something we would bring as a gift to God to demonstrate our appreciation for God. And now, we can't bring it to God as a gift, so we shouldn't have it ourselves either. Shall we drink wine, which used to be poured on the altar, and it's now halted? Can't do it. So he's ready for them. He knew that they were going to say that. He replied, then we shouldn't eat bread, because you can't bring the flour offerings anymore. So don't eat bread either. They said, huh, you know, you're right. We can eat produce. We'll have fresh fruit. He said, no, you can't do that either. We shouldn't eat produce, because the gift of the first produce is halted, right? The bikurim we mentioned before, the first fruits. We can't bring those gifts to God. We don't have a temple anymore. So you shouldn't eat that either. Okay, we can eat other produce, because the mitzvah of the bikurim, of the first fruits, is primarily the 7 species for which Israel is known. Wheat, barley, grapes, olives, figs, dates, and pomegranates. That's what Israel is most known for. That's the first fruits. So all right, we'll eat cucumbers. Cucumbers and tomatoes. We'll have an Israeli salad. That's what we'll do, they said. But he's ready for that too. He says, we shouldn't drink water, for the libation of water is halted. Because every year on Sukkot, they would pour water on the altar as part of prayers to God for rain. So now we shouldn't drink water either. At that point, they fell silent. Because now what? What are you going to do? He said, my children, let me tell you something. Not to mourn at all is impossible. The decree has been made. We've suffered. And we have to mourn for that. There has to be some level of grieving. Mourning too much is impossible. For one cannot issue a decree upon the community unless most of the community can bear it. You can't destroy the Jewish world over what happened. There has to be a limit to it. And Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Horowitz, in that article I mentioned, put it beautifully. In source number 10, we said, when the month of Av enters, we reduce our joy. He said, notice the wording. We reduce our joy. Source number 13, when Av enters, the Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish law, codifies, we lessen, we reduce our happiness. Tellingly, though, we are exhorted to lessen it, not to discontinue it. In the Hebrew, it's mema'atin b'simcha. We reduce our joy, but not ein simcha, there's no joy. You can't destroy the nation in pursuit of remembering the pain of the destruction. So this is Zecher l'Churban. This is the idea of remembering the pain, and this is the one that I think our community does well, in the sense that we have all sorts of Holocaust memorial programs. We have movies, we have speakers. Right? Jews do grief fairly well. We know what pain is, and we know how to experience it. Unfortunately, sometimes it's too intense, and there are people who won't go because they can't. When they go to programs like that, it's simply traumatic for them. And not just talk about survivors, but even people after that. It's too enveloping. But that's only one half of how we remember. I want to talk about the other half, the Zecher LeMikdash. Remembering the sanctuary, remembering the temple, because if we're going to speak of them as being kedoshim, as holy people, there must be a zecher lemikdash. You have to remember that which was holy, and remembering that which was holy means not remembering the pain, but remembering what was good from before that. And the way you remember that is not simply intellectual, but by reenacting what we had. The Talmud says this in source number 14. It asks, how do we know to memorialize the temple? How do we know that we should actually create ritual, create actions which will remind us of the temple? Rabbi Yochanan quoted a verse from Jeremiah. God says, I will bring you healing and I will cure your wounds. This is the word of God. For they called you banished. She is Zion. No one seeks her. She is Zion. Nobody seeks her. Doresh ein la. So on that, the Talmud says, no one seeks her. That teaches that she requires seeking. We're supposed to seek her. We are supposed to be looking for Zion. We're supposed to be trying to bring back to life that which we had. And that leads to a whole bunch of practices. We talked about the Seder a little bit before. The Korech sandwich, right? Matzah and the Mari, dip it in the charoset, right? There's a little paragraph that you say when you eat that. It begins with the words, Zecher LeMikdash, right? Zecher LeMikdash, Hillel Kenas HaHillel, and so on. This is to remember the temple, like Hillel, and so on. That was instituted to remember what they did. And not just that. You know how there's an early part in the Seder where people wash their hands right before they have the karpas?
At the beginning of the Seder.
Right. Why are we washing our hands? We never wash our hands for produce. For bread, we wash our hands traditionally. What is this about the produce? The answer may be, there are different opinions, as always, but one opinion is that it's because when you go back to the temple times, they washed for produce as a function of the laws of purity and impurity. And we are reenacting that as a way to reenact what they used to do. It's bringing it back to life. But it's not only about Passover. Another one is Sukkot. We have a mitzvah on Sukkot of taking the lulav and esrog, right? The lulav and etrog, the four species. The Torah says that you're only supposed to take that for one day. Ulkachtem lachem bayom arishon. Take this for yourself on the first day of Sukkot. How many days do we do it? Right, the full 7 days. 7 days we take it. Not Shmini Atzeres, but 7 days we do it. Why seven? Because there's another verse that says that you shall celebrate before God for 7 days. And based on that, in the temple, they would take the lulav for 7 days because they're in front of God. And after the temple was destroyed, we said, Zecher LeMikdash, to remember what they did in the temple, all of us are going to do it for 7 days. The first day is the biblical mitzvah. The rest of it is just a practice to remember the temple. And on and on. We have various mitzvot that we perform that are really just rituals meant to bring to life that which we once had. And to me, the same thing is true regarding the practices of our ancestors, Jewish and otherwise. But when we talk about remembering them, it is insufficient to remember the pain of their death. It's also about reliving their life. And so to say, what did they do? How did they do this? I have a friend who did this great thing. I feel like I might have mentioned it in this group at some point. He lost his grandparents in the Shoah. And his father did not know, like, all the different customs that his grandparents had had. So he went and found a survivor from their town in Hungary, and he quizzed the survivor. Question after question of what did they do in that town? What material did they use to cover their sukkah? What, you know, did they sit or stand when they made kiddush? What tune did they use when they prayed? What songs did they sing at the table on Shabbat? He wanted to know what were their customs that he could do what we're talking about here, Zecher LeMikdash, to remember the temple. It isn't only about that. But that happens to be, you know, I'm a rabbi, so I'm going to talk about the Jewish things. But this is how you relive. And this is how you make them part of us. When we talk about our three goals, learning the practical lessons of their lives, and when you talk about wanting to make their identity our identity and to honor them, not just to talk about how they died. You know, I'm sure you've had the experience of going to a funeral or going to a shiva house, in which the eulogy or the things people talk about are how they suffered for the last couple of years of their life or their last hospitalization. And look, who am I to question that? People are grieving and that's what's on their mind. But we want to be able to remember what it was like before then, what their life was like before that happened, what they were like as kids, what they were like as young marrieds, what they were like in their heyday, so to speak. That's also a very big part. And so there's this element, which isn't a sad element. This is a joyous element. This is a happy element. Reenacting who they were, bringing them back to life effectively. And so take a look at source number 15, where the Boston Rebbe makes this great comment. He says in number 15, he says, the same Jew who spends his midnight hours reciting Tikkun Chatzos in tearful memory of the destruction. Tikkun Chatzos is a prayer which goes all the way back to Talmudic times and has been practiced ever since, ebbing and flowing in terms of how much people did it. It was very big in certain parts of Europe pre-war. It involved rising in the middle of the night to recite prayers to grieve for the destruction of the temple. So the same Jew who spends his midnight hours doing this, mourning for the destruction, nevertheless marches proudly and happily around the Bima in Shul with his Esrog and Lulav on Sukkot in commemoration of temple times. This is the happy commemoration. So he not only cries in remembrance of the temple, he dances too. You can tell he's a chassid writing this. The same family that sits on the floor on Erev Tisha B'Av eating eggs and ashes, several months later sets a luxuriant table for its Pesach meal, and leaning in a kingly manner, eats matzah and maror, the bitter herbs wrapped together, to remember how Hillel ate it in the time of the temple. Matzah and maror are not the only things wrapped together at the Seder. Our joy and our remembrance are intertwined too. You remember the pain of Egypt, you remember the maror, the bitter herbs, but you also remember the matzah we ate on the way out. Not only in Korech, he says, though, not only in the matzah sandwich, but also the roasted egg and shankbone and the seder plate, the afikomen as well, all commemorations of what we had in the Beis HaMikdash in the temple that is no longer standing. The two go together. And that, to me, is the thing that we need to really work on. Reliving the pain of it is something I think we do well, but I think investigating and finding out how they lived and bringing that into our lives and the lives of our children is, I think, critical. Last point. The verse in Leviticus, actually I brought it for you, number 16. After a description in the book of Vayikra, the book of Leviticus, about a period of suffering for the Jewish people, God then promises the following. It's in italics in number 16. I will remember my covenant with Jacob, and also my covenant with Isaac, and also my covenant with Abraham I will remember, and the land I will remember. The reason why it mentions the men is not to exclude the women, but because the concept of brit is found in the Torah specifically regarding these males. It's not a misogynist statement. But look at what it says. I will remember my covenant with Jacob, right? My covenant with Isaac, and also my covenant with Abraham I will remember, and the land I will remember. What's the difference between what's said for Abraham and Jacob and not for Isaac? What's missing?
Remember.
The land is a separate point, an important point as well. But the key is that the word remember is missing when he talks about Isaac.
Yeah.
He remembers the covenant with Jacob. He remembers the covenant with Abraham. Clearly, the Isaac one is being brought in too. It must be remembered as well. So why is the verb missing? Medrash picks it up and picks up on it. The sharp ear of the rabbis picks up on it. Take a look at number 16, the text there after the italics. Why does it say regarding Jacob and Abraham, I will remember, but not regarding Isaac? Rabbi Brechia and the sages debated. Rabbi Brechia said because he suffered. God doesn't need to call into mind the suffering of Isaac is omnipresent. The sages said, an answer which frankly resonates the same way. It's not that far off in terms of its answer. God sees the ashes of Isaac as though they were now collected on the altar. What's that reference, the ashes of Isaac?
Well,
the Akedah, the binding of Isaac. Tell me something. Were there ashes of Isaac at the Akedah?
No.
No, he got saved, right?
Yeah.
So what do you mean, the ashes of Isaac? Writes Rabbi Horowitz, the Bostoner Rebbe. He says, it's not Isaac's ashes. It's the ashes of Isaac's descendants. Hmm. Who learned from that story and who were in fact martyred. Because then there really are ashes. And what we're saying here is that the sacrifices that were made through the ages are constantly in front of God. They're always there within his memory. He doesn't need to call it to mind. He doesn't need to make an effort to remember because it's always there in front of him. We're at a pivotal moment in Jewish history because for the past 70 plus years, the ashes have been in front of us, so to speak. Because we had survivors and because we had people who knew those who had been killed, it was right in front of us. It's not a secret. We're reaching a moment in history where they're not going to be right in front of us.
Yeah.
And so it's all the more important that we make that effort to learn about them. To learn about how they lived their lives, to learn about what their practices were, what their beliefs were, what their worldview was, and to make sure that that's passed along with all the pages of testimony in Yad Vashem, and reporting all of the data and the records to make sure that it's not forgotten, but to remember how they lived as well, and to pass that along and reenact it in our own lives. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Yes, Beverly.